All right, everybody. Good afternoon. This is the regularly scheduled meeting of the Portland City Council on February 2nd, 2017. Clerk, if you could please call the roll.
Fritz.
Here.
Fish.
Here.
Saltzman.
Here.
Udaly.
Here.
Wheeler.
Here. So a couple of housekeeping items. First of all, there are a ton of people here, and that's a great thing. It's a good thing for democracy. However, we are not allowed to block the aisles. So I want to make people aware that there is an overflow room in the Portland building. It's the blue building right across the street in the auditorium on the second floor. When we get to the point of public testimony, you won't be left out if you're there. The clerk will call names six deep, so you'll have plenty of time to be able to make your way over here to the council chambers, so that you'll be able to testify, and it's my understanding there's already quite a few people there. So that's the first thing. I want to let you know the order of things. I'm going to speak very briefly on the, I'm going to take a liberty as the presiding officer and speak very briefly to item 106. We'll then go to 105, which is what the majority of people are here to discuss. I'm going to turn the microphone over to Commissioner Udaly. She will introduce the joint item. She will then introduce invited testimony. I'll then ask my colleagues if there are any amendments that they would like to place on the table, and I know that there are some amendments that will be placed at that time, and then we'll go into the public testimony, assuming there aren't further board council deliberations at that particular time. I want to be very emphatic today about allowing people's testimony to be heard. This is an issue that people are very passionate about. There are lots of different opinions on these issues, and everybody has a right to be heard respectfully in this room. So I would ask, if you like what you're hearing, give a thumbs up. If you don't like what you're hearing, you can give a thumbs down. That's fine, but we don't have time for cheering. We certainly don't want booing or other expressions. We want to be respectful for all people, and Commissioner Udaly and I have agreed that that is how we would like to comport this meeting today, so that everybody has an opportunity to be heard. When we get to the general testimony, I know that there are a number of people with small children who are here, and given that this testimony is probably going to go on for quite some time, I'd like to offer people with small children the ability to come up first in the queue, or people who might have some disabilities that require them to come up early in the queue, or others who have hardships that require them to come forward in the queue. I'd ask that they please get the clerk's attention, or when they sign up for public testimony, when you sign up for public testimony, if you could just denote that, that would be very helpful, and we'll try and accommodate you first. So without further ado, with the agreement of my colleagues, Commissioner Udaly and I would like to withdraw item number 106. Instead, what we have decided to do is draft a letter. It's essentially a mayoral directive. It goes to the Office of Management and Finance as well as the City Budget Office. What it seeks to do is reduce the cost, the time, and any, what you know, for lack of a better word, hassle factor associated with bringing affordable housing online in the city of Portland. It was being brought as a resolution, but in conversations with my colleagues, we don't need to have a resolution. I believe through directive, I can get this process going as a part of the ongoing budget process. Commissioner Udaly, who co-introduced Resolution 106 with me, is in concurrence. I've had a chance to meet with my fellow commissioners, and we're all in agreement. Particularly given the time that item number 105 is going to take, that it's best if we withdraw 106 and simply make that a mayoral directive. So that is what I'm going to do with the agreement of my colleagues. So ordered. Clerk, if you could read the next and only item for today's meeting. And I should have mentioned one other thing. It is now 2:15. We're going to try and get out of here at 6, so we'll do a reassessment at about 5:30 and see where we are with regard to public testimony, and we may take a break or two over the course of the the hearing for what Commissioner Fish likes to call humanitarian purposes. So with that, please read the item.
Item 105, amend affordable housing preservation and Portland renter protections to add relocation assistance for involuntary displacements of tenants.
Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, Mayor. Colleagues, community members, and special guests, thank you for joining us today to hear testimony on the relocation emergency ordinance. First, some housekeeping items. Parents and care providers, we've set up a child care room on the third floor with snacks and crafts. I think most of you have discovered it. But if you haven't, please check in with Polly Ann at the front desk in my office, which is just to your left out here, on this floor before proceeding to the third floor. We have asked most of our invited guests, or guests giving invited testimony, to limit their testimony to 3 minutes. So we can move on quickly to open up the conversation to public comment. Depending on the number of people who signed up to comment, and I heard that it was over 100, we may need to reduce the time from 3 minutes at some point in order to hear from everyone before that 5:30 cutoff. I want to encourage you, if your point has been made, to perhaps not repeat it and just come forward and express your support and save some time for people coming up behind you. And also think about the most essential message you have to share in case you're going to have to edit 3 minutes down to 2 or 1. We have arranged for interpreters for Spanish and Cantonese speakers to assist with testimony, and those speakers will be given extra time to accommodate interpretation. Finally, I just want to reiterate what Mayor Wheeler has requested, that we do keep disruptions to a minimum, because as much as we love to yell and cheer, that does take time away from public testimony and heats up the room. So I would love to see a lot of twinkle fingers today, or thumbs, or whatever. Okay, so I've been living and breathing affordable housing and tenants' rights issues for the past 2 years. It's what inspired me to run for city council, and is in no small part why I was elected. Because the fact is, the majority of Portlanders support rent stabilization and increasing tenant protections. Some people have asked me, what's the rush on this ordinance? The fact is, members of my team were working on relocation for months before we took office, and this housing crisis has been growing for the past decade. So we have to ask, what's taking so long? Emotions are high on both sides of this debate. For the past 30 years, landlords have been allowed to involuntarily displace tenants through no cause and de facto economic evictions. And now we're asking them to share in the burden that has been wrought on our residents, our communities, our city, and our entire region. The fact is, we're all paying for this crisis, whether it's through the public dollars we spend on affordable housing, rental assistance, and homelessness, or the various ways that this crisis is harming our neighborhoods, communities, schools, small businesses, local economy, and the overall quality of life for all of our residents. As former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich recently said, governing by anecdote is not governing, it's demagoguery. And it's been disappointing and frustrating to witness opponents to tenant protections, whether community members, lobbyists, or legislators, resort to playing on the public's emotions and prejudices rather than basing their positions on facts. But I'm going to share a personal anecdote with you today anyway. My parents became landlords in 1979 when they bought their second home and moved our family from Gales Creek to Sherwood. Early on, they made a misjudgment in tenants and ended up having to evict them for non-payment of rent and other serious infractions. The tenants responded by breaking every window in the house, filling it with garbage, and using it as a dog kennel for an untold number of days. So you can imagine what that looked like. My father was driving home from assessing and photographing the damage on a rainy day in October 1983. He lost control of his vehicle on a tight curve hit an oncoming truck, and died instantly. So, if you've come here today to conjure up the bad tenant boogeyman, the one that precludes us from protecting any tenants, lest we somehow benefit him, please save your breath. I have already met him. And I recognize him for what he is, an anomaly among an ocean of good tenants who follow the rules, who desperately need their deposits back, who are highly dependent on their landlord's good reference, and in one of the most competitive rental markets the city has ever seen. If you have a bad tenant, you have clear legal recourse, and the law is weighted in the landlord's favor. We don't call our eviction court an eviction mill for nothing. If you've come here today to argue exemptions for mom-and-pop landlords who may experience some level of financial hardship if required to pay relocation assistance, let me remind you, landlords have been placing that very same hardship on tenants who are generally lower income and have less financial resources than property owners. This is a temporary emergency ordinance intended to stabilize or assist renters at risk of involuntary displacement during our housing crisis. We hope that it will be short-lived, but that will require the state legislature to overturn the ban on rent control and give the city back its regulatory tools. In the meantime, there's an easy way to avoid relocation assistance. Do not no-cause evict your tenants, and don't raise their rent 10% or more per year.
Again, thumbs up or jazz hands.
I got distracted by the twinkle fingers. Okay.
It's hard to get used to, I understand.
If you've come here today to tell us we must simply build our way out of this crisis, I can confidently tell you, as the commissioner in charge of the Bureau of Development Services and someone with a newfound inside view of our housing bureau, it will take decades to build our way out. And that's only if developers are willing to start building for existing demand, which is not the market rate and luxury housing that they are primarily delivering. If you've come here today to suggest that renters just move or get better jobs, it shows an utter lack of understanding around who is taking the brunt of the impact created by our housing crisis. Seniors and people with disabilities living on fixed incomes don't have the resources to move or the ability to get better jobs. People of color who have faced historic and ongoing discrimination in both the housing and the job markets also tend to have more limited resources and options. Telling someone with limited resources to leave behind their family, their friends, and their community in search of elusive, affordable housing elsewhere is terrible advice. Finally, this is not a landlord versus tenants conversation. We are not seeking to demonize or penalize landlords, but we are asking them to recognize their role in our housing crisis and share in the burden they're creating, not just for their renters, but our entire city, when they choose to involuntarily displace a renter through no fault of the renter. We've heard from many landlords who support this ordinance, some of whom will be testifying today, who know that they can profitably operate their business, whether they choose to avoid triggering relocation or not. We don't blame landlords for not recognizing how the forces of urban renewal, gentrification, displacement, and limited tenant protections converge to create this crisis over the past 30 years. But there's no denying the outcome. Half our residents are renters. Half of renters are cost-burdened by rent, and half of those renters, approximately 75,000 people, live in households that are spending over 50% of their income on housing. These households are being forced to choose between paying rent and paying the heating bill, paying rent and paying for vital medical care, paying rent and paying the grocery bill. This is unsustainable, it's unacceptable, and none of the good people of Portland, renters, homeowners, or landlords, should be willing to sit idly by and let this crisis continue unchecked. will now bring up our invited guests, starting with our staff presentation from Jamie Duhamel, Policy Director for my office, Matt Schabold, Portland Housing Bureau, and Mark Jolin from A Home for Everyone.
And I just want to remind people about council rules. If you're a lobbyist, please state so for the record. If you represent an organization, if you could state that too, we'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Jamie Duhamel. I'm the Policy Director for Commissioner Chloe Udaly. I appreciate your time today, and it's going to be a long one. So I'm going to keep my comments brief. I'm going to just outline what the ordinance is and is not, and then I'll let these two gentlemen kind of fill in the gaps as far as the findings of that ordinance and how we came to that. And then there will be a series of invited guests who will also be here to kind of fill in the gaps of what this ordinance is before we get to public testimony. So I think you now understand the purpose of this relocation assistance proposal, which is to mitigate the damages of involuntary displacements. At its core, this ordinance will require relocation to be given within 14 days of any no-cause eviction. It will also require relocation assistance to be given after notice of a rent increase over 10% in a 12-month period. The tenant, this one's a little different than the first one. In the case of a rent increase, the tenant has to give notice within 14 days that they cannot absorb the increase and have to move because of it. The landlord then has 14 additional days with which to pay that relocation assistance. So relocation assistance, as we've defined it in this ordinance, is a flat rate based on the average price of rents across the city based on unit size. We got those numbers from the Portland Housing Bureau's State of Housing in Portland 2016 report. The averages were tripled and rounded to the nearest 100. The reason that we did that was because we wanted to create the most equitable system for tenants and for landlords at the same time. What we found when we were discussing how we would come to an equitable amount was that if we simply just asked the landlord to pay 3 months worth of rent, whatever they're paying, we actually create a problem in that the low-income tenants who most often need relocation assistance the most are also paying the least amount in rent. And those who make more money and need relocation assistance less are actually paying higher rates of rent. Therefore, a landlord could be paying upwards of $6,000-$7,000 to one tenant and maybe as low as $1,800 to another tenant. And the tenant getting the lesser amount is obviously in more need. So this was a system that we established to make it equitable for those tenants so that they had a good chance of finding additional housing within those ranges of market rates, but additionally so that landlords have the ability to plan ahead. They know exactly how much they're going to have to pay per unit. It's a business decision that they can take into account when they buy a building or when they take over units or when they decide if they're going to do all sorts of things with their property. We wanted that to be something that they could count on. So how this ordinance will apply, there are three exemptions to the relocation assistance the way it is now. Week-to-week tenancies, which are essentially its own kind of beast that's really, those are designed for kind of like hotels and that kind of thing, so that's an easy one. Tenants and landlords who occupy the same unit, let's say a landlord who is renting out rooms within their home, they are exempt from relocation assistance. And sabbatical lease arrangements, meaning your primary residence that you rent out while you, let's say you're shipped off for the military or you're going on an extended vacation or you're going out of the country for a little while, but intend to return to your primary residence, you are also exempted from relocation assistance. It will apply to just about everything else, meaning all month-to-month tenancies, those periodic term leases that automatically perpetuate and turn into month-to-month leases at the end, as well as fixed-term leases. That's all written that way into the ordinance. It is a broad policy that is intended to be as simple and straightforward as possible because as of yet we don't really have the ability to facilitate more nuanced policies that would require our oversight. We are trying to be as straightforward as possible to avoid complications and confusions for both landlords and for tenants. As an emergency ordinance, it is intended to take effect immediately and will affect any 90-day notice periods currently in process and not completed. This ordinance is tied to the housing state of emergency, set to be reviewed again in October, but will require a separate affirmative vote to review or to renew. And I just want to say one final thing that it taking effect on 90-day notice periods that are currently in process is an important point for the commissioner and mayor to remember today, because this will impact three entire apartment complexes that are currently in this process. I'm sure you've heard of them by now, and many of them will be here to testify today, including many residents from the Normandy Apartments who just received a 100% rent increase that will go into effect April 1st. Titan Manor is a 70-unit apartment complex in Portland that just received all no-cause evictions, as well as a 8-unit apartment complex that houses elderly folks and low-income folks, one of whom I've heard is 90 years old and has lived in her apartment for almost 20 years. They all received no-cause evictions that will go into effect soon. So that's it for my portion of the testimony, and I think Matt is going to kind of illuminate the numbers around why this is important.
All right. Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, Matthew Schaubold with the Housing Bureau, and I'm here to talk a little bit about who renters are in Portland and the situation they face in the market as a foundation of data for the conversation. I'll try and be brief because I know there's a lot of testimony, and we'll be having a long hearing today. So it's been mentioned already, but Portland has roughly 250,000 to 260,000 households within the city, depending on the year of the census data you're looking at. And roughly 47% of all households within the city are renter households. Communities of color are disproportionately renters to white households, and communities of color are disproportionately low income, which makes them particularly vulnerable in today's housing market. When you look at the split between income tranches for renter households specifically, so this is looking at our roughly 120,000 renter households in the city, 50% or almost 50% of renter households earn less than $2,900 per month. And $2,900 per month is about $34,800 per year. There is a spread, and it exists on both ends of the spectrum. While the bulk of renters do exist in the lower income tranches, there are a sizable chunk of renters that have incomes above $4,200 per month. When you look at the renter households that are paying more than 30% of income to rent, which for folks not familiar with housing policy, we consider paying 30% of your income affordable, you'll see that for the most part, this almost 50% of renters earning less than $2,900 per month, almost all of them are paying more than 30% of their income for rent, 86, 87%. The number drops dramatically when you move to higher income levels, 46% for folks earning between $2,900 and $4,200 per month, and then we would consider it affordable for most renters in the city if they earn more than $4,200 per month. When you look at what's been going on in the last decade in Portland at rent increases, we've obviously seen cycles, but what we're seeing thus far is very dramatic rent increases in the last 4 to 5 years. And the impact that that's had on renter households has been significant when you consider the fact that a large majority of renters in Portland are low-income or moderate-income households. And when we look at the 30 to 35% increase in rent that's occurred in the last 4 to 5 years in total, incomes have not kept up. And thus, more and more families are struggling to make ends meet. So we went ahead and made some basic assumptions to kind of think through what an average cost of relocation would be in the city. And there's some major caveats I want to put on here. So we're assuming a very basic level of relocation assistance is needed when somebody has to move. And that's first month's rent, last month's rent, and a security deposit equal to 1 month rent. Every household's personal circumstance is different. The need to take time off work, the need to acquire storage, the need to rent a truck or a van to move, that will vary household by household. But assuming these basic assumptions for all, If you were to take the average rent as of last week in Portland, the average rent across the city is $1,445 per month. And so looking at first, last, and security deposit, it would cost the average renter household in the city about $4,500 in order to move, plus whatever moving expenses they have given their personal circumstances. When you look at that number in the context of household incomes that I mentioned earlier in the presentation, what you'll see is that for households earning less than $1,700 per month, of which there are roughly 20 to 25% of our renters in the city, that's 2.5 months worth of income. So a renter household at that income level would need to have in savings or the ability to access 2.5 times their monthly income in order to cover all those initial moving costs. I won't read all the numbers here, but what you can see is those first two income categories, the amount of income needed is over a month's worth of income to be able to secure a new apartment. Plus, I should mention, this does not include any moving costs or setup costs for any internet or other sorts of utilities that a household might have in their new rental home. So that's just some numbers in brief to kind of set a foundation. I'm happy to answer any questions, but I'll just let Mark make his statement and then turn it over.
All right. Thank you, Mayor and City Council members. My name is Mark Cholin. I'm here today as the Director of the City-County Joint Office of Homeless Services. I appreciate the invitation to come and speak a little bit to you about the consequences of the way the rental market is impacting low-income households and homelessness in our community. In partnership with the Housing Bureau and the County Department of Human Services, our office tries to address homelessness first through prevention by keeping people from becoming homeless in the first place. Over the last several years, that has been an increasingly difficult thing to do. We have tens of thousands of very low-income households who are already rent-burdened, paying 50, 60, 70% or more of their very limited income toward rent. In my previous work at JOIN, we routinely had people on long-term disability bringing in less than $800 a month who were paying as much as 100% of that income toward rent. In that situation, any little thing that went wrong could put them back on the street. When those extremely rent-burdened families have a temporary interruption in income or an unplanned expense, they face homelessness. In some cases, we can help them keep their housing by stepping in with temporary rental assistance. Our nonprofits were able to do that for thousands of people last year. But when those already rent-burdened families experience the kinds of double and sometimes triple-digit percentage rent increases that we've seen over the last several years, short-term rent assistance can only forestall the inevitable. Unless their incomes increase proportionate to rent, which is not happening for the low-income people in our community, they will eventually lose their housing. And while in this market, finding alternative affordable housing units is a challenge, Portland has about one affordable unit for every 5 extremely low-income households who need one. Finding replacement housing is only the first challenge. Once a family has found a unit, they too often can't come up with the several thousand dollars in first and last month's rent and deposit that landlords are requiring to get into units. The result? In too many cases, families that receive excessive rent increases or no-cause evictions can't find and raise the funds to get into alternative housing in time, and they become homeless. That explains why, even as with expanded city and county investments, we've helped a record number of people with prevention assistance and helped a record number of people get back into permanent housing, over 4,600 people last year, the demand for emergency shelter has continued to increase. Last February, we opened a new, larger 130-bed family shelter after demand outstripped what the old 90-bed shelter could accommodate. Almost immediately, that shelter was full and went into overflow mode. Now, even with nearly 30 families being sheltered in motel rooms, there are routinely more than 220 people in families spending the night in the Human Solutions family shelter. And we're having the same experience with adult shelters. In the last year, we opened 200 beds of shelter at the Hanson Building, and they immediately filled. We opened 90 beds at the Gresham Women's Shelter, and they immediately filled. We opened 120 beds for women and couples at the Willamette Center, and they are full. And with this winter, we've added 180 winter shelter beds for men and women downtown, the most recent one just a couple of weeks ago, and those beds immediately filled up too. We see this continued surge in people facing homelessness and other data as well. In the first quarter of this fiscal year, 211 Info, our community's information and referral line, fielded over 11,000 inquiries from people seeking help with housing. It was 50% of their calls. Within that, the most common requests in order were for shelter, rent assistance, and subsidized housing. The next most common issue was utility assistance at just under 10% of their calls. Compare that to the first quarter of 2014, where they received less than half as many housing-related calls, and those calls made up just 22% of their inquiries. When we look at the homeless system as a whole, we find that a significant majority of the people receiving shelter and housing assistance are new to the system, meaning they haven't accessed services in the last 2 years. And our shelters are reporting high percentages of families who have never been homeless before. The significant investments that the city and county, Home Forward, and our nonprofit partners are making in prevention and housing placement have made the situation better than it otherwise would have been. But the rash of large rent increases and no-cause evictions is overwhelming our resources. Those agencies continue to turn away dozens of people seeking rent assistance for each family they are able to help. Not only are more people in jeopardy of becoming homeless because of what is happening in our housing market, every successful intervention that we are able to provide costs more money, more to cover rent, more to cover our deposit and move-in fees. So the resources we do have are not going as far. We are estimating that just based on increases in rents, our nonprofit agencies will be able to serve 8 to 10% fewer households with our current funding level next year. In short, our efforts to help people avoid becoming homeless and to help those who have become homeless get back into permanent housing are more significant than ever, and yet we won't be successful if we don't address what is happening to low-income households in this rental market.
So we are happy to be available for questions as you talk about amendments. Otherwise, I think it's time for invited testimony.
Thank you.
So I have two quick questions, and I know we have a lot of people queued up, but I want to just get two additional facts on the table, which I think they're helpful. Starting with you, Matthew, when we talk about cost burden, we're talking about people pay more than 30% of their income for their housing. Who sets that figure, and what is it based on?
So the figure is actually set by the Department of Housing and Urban Development at the federal level, and an assessment is made of the area median income, so the Portland metro area, of what the median income is and what different income tranches are, and then the 30% calculation is based on those income tranches.
Just to put a finer point on it, for people that are lucky enough to get a Section 8 voucher, what that effectively means is the voucher allows them to rent an apartment but limits their rent to 30% of their income.
That's correct.
And my second question is the marketplace of rental housing. And I had asked this previously because I wanted a better sense of the market. Do we have good numbers in terms of how many single-family duplexes, triplexes, and multifamily units, and is there some way for us to kind of quantify the universe of rentals?
I asked Deborah MC, the executive director of Multifamily Northwest, if she had any data. She said they did not have data, and she did not know where we could find such data.
Oh, I, Commissioner, I have some data. I actually have it right here in front of me.
Apparently, we have the data.
So it's broken out into different size buildings or units in the city, and what I'll say is that 60% of the housing units in the city are single-family detached or single-family attached, so single-family housing units. So single-family homes is what most people know them as. And of those, about 22% of those are rentals. If I was to scale up a little bit, 80% of the housing stock in the city, the buildings have 20 units or less. And so this is 2015 ACS five-year estimate, so there's a bit of a lag. We know in the last couple of years we've seen a lot of very high-density multifamily permitted and in construction. But the 5 years from 2015 would indicate 80% is 9 units or lower.
I'm sorry. I'm
80% of the housing, the structures have 9 units or fewer.
Okay, that's helpful. Good. Thank you.
Yeah. Lesson learned. Always ask Matt.
Okay. Our first panel is Multnomah County Commission Chair Deborah Cafori, Andy Miller from Human Solutions, and Vivian Lyons, tenant attorney.
Good afternoon. And again, as always, if you could just state your name for the record, please.
Great, thank you. My name is Deborah Kafori, and I'm the chair of Multnomah County. I want to thank you for having me here today, and thank you, Commissioner and Mayor, for your leadership on this issue. A little over a week ago, I read in the Willamette Week, as many of us did, the story about families living at the Normandy Apartments. 26 children live in the building's 18 units, more than 5% of the student body in the neighborhood elementary school. And the building's new owners had just sent every tenant notice of a rent increase, a 100% rent increase. For parents who can't afford that, they will have to move their kids to a different school, maybe even a different school district, at a key point in the school year. As a parent, and as someone who works with families who have lost their housing, I know what this disruption does to kids. It knocks them back. It sets them up for failure. Across the county, we're seeing families in this crisis as they pack up and move from school to school, district to district, chasing that elusive, affordable apartment. So I asked county staff, what could we do? To date, we've been able to find $48,000 in rent assistance through our Sun School Network to help keep the families with kids in the Normandy Apartments until the end of the school year. We're still looking for a solution for the other tenants, and time may run out. I'm not telling you this story because it represents success. We may not find the resources to help the other tenants. We don't have enough money to help every family across our county who is experiencing this same crisis. I'm sure you will hear from many people today talking about the need for more housing as the long-term answer to this crisis. And I agree. We need more housing. Particularly, we need more units affordable to those with very low incomes, roughly 30% of the area median. And I know and I applaud this council for being committed to making that a reality. But we have to recognize that for families living on the edge, they can't wait. Every day, there are more moms and dads in our county that are going to work at minimum wage. And at the end of the month, if they're lucky, they've got enough to cover the rent. And every day, they live in fear that the mail will include a rent increase they can't afford or a no-cause eviction. That's why we dedicated $30 million in new city and county resources last year to homeless services and prevention. With our new investments, we've kept thousands of people in their homes and put thousands of people back into housing. And that's why I hope you'll help me keep that funding in place this next year and ensure that we can keep increasing the number of people we help. But we can't expect taxpayers alone to fill this gap. They can't afford it. I hear from seniors who call my office and say that they're struggling to pay their property tax bills, even when they support the efforts that the city and the county are doing. It breaks my heart. We are in this mess today because the federal government walked away from our seniors, our working mothers, and our children 30 years ago and defunded housing and urban development. So instead of building the thousands of affordable homes we need during these years, we're 25,000 units short. And now, if you can believe anything you hear out of the White House, it sounds as if they're dead set on playing the same game again, walking away from our community at a key moment in our history. So it is up to us. Every one of us in this room today, we need to come together, we need to step up, and every one of us needs to do our part. And I think that's what this ordinance is all about. It's about saying to landlords who are doing the right thing, thank you. And it's about putting in place some safeguards when things go wrong. I know that the City Council is committed to making this work, and if you adopt this ordinance today, it doesn't mean that you won't work with our community to make sure that the rules on the books work for everyone. Thank you, and thank you for bringing this forward and for seeing it through.
Thank you, Deborah. Tough act to follow. Good afternoon, Mayor Wheeler, members of the City Council. I'm Andy Miller. I'm the Executive Director of Human Solutions. For those of you who don't know us all that well, and I think most of you do, but I'll say it anyway, we're a nonprofit organization serving East Portland and East Multnomah County. We have some perspective on this ordinance and the housing crisis the community is experiencing because we see its impacts every day. We provide eviction prevention services that have helped hundreds of families avoid the trauma of homelessness. We operate 2 year-round homeless shelters, one for families and one for single women, and we see what's happening with folks experiencing homelessness. You heard from Mark how those shelters are overflowing on a nightly basis. And we work closely with many private landlords. There are good landlords willing to work with tenants and agencies like ours, where we invest dollars that your city council and the county commission have invested in successful programs that are moving people out of homelessness. Tonight, roughly 5,000 Portlanders will be safely inside instead of outside because of what we are able to do, and the great majority of those are kids. That's work that this council has historically invested in, and we thank you for that investment. It's making an enormous difference. The programs we operate do work. Your investment is a good investment. But there simply aren't enough dollars to keep up with the demand, and there are limits to the solutions we can provide in the current context, and that's what this ordinance today is really about. When families come in with rent increases of 10, 20, or even 50% that we're seeing on a very regular basis, rent assistance programs begin to become ineffective. They're just unsustainable if the rents continue to go up unregulated. And unfortunately, we have no program that can respond to a no-cause eviction. There's no amount of money that we can offer that will make that go away. No-cause evictions are simply the most common reason given by families coming into our shelter every night. So we're seeing a huge influx of families coming into the homeless shelter. Most of them are saying they received a no-cause eviction. So what's happening? Well, we're raising a generation of kids in this community who are experiencing residential displacement and homelessness at record rates. Every indicator we have tells us that when kids are forced to move, change schools, experience homelessness, every opportunity they have to succeed in school, to form healthy friendship bonds, to advance physical and emotional health in a positive way, all of those opportunities are destroyed. This is unconscionable. It's not healthy for our kids or our community. You're going to hear today testimony about whether this ordinance is fair. What I would ask you is, are we being fair to our kids, and especially our families and kids of color who experience this disproportionately? Are we being equitable? We talk a lot about equity in this community. This is an opportunity to be equitable. I urge you to vote for this ordinance. It's good public policy for 3 reasons. First, it creates a disincentive for some of the most destabilizing actions, massive rent increases, and no-cause evictions. That's an important disincentive to insert into the system. It also rebalances some of the current burden to respond to those destabilizing actions from the tenant families themselves and from the taxpayers who support the safety net system that responds to them to the landlords who initiate these actions. And as Commissioner Daly began by saying, for landlords that do not want to bear that burden, there's a simple solution that many good landlords are already practicing. Pace rent increases reasonably, and don't use no-cause evictions. Finally, it's good public policy because it extends our limited safety net and public investment even further. It will simply allow us as an agency and agencies like Human Solutions to serve more families by rebalancing that burden. I'll say one last thing, and that's that I fully support this ordinance, but we all know it's not enough. If we don't take swift action behind this ordinance to regulate rents and deal with no-cause evictions, giving somebody a payment that we call a relocation payment when there's no place to relocate to, well, it's like a tow truck driver towing your car away and giving you a gas card and saying, this will get you home. It's just not enough. So we need a more systemic and comprehensive response. And when you're ready to take that on, we'll be here with you. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a thumbs up. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Vivian Lyon.
I just want to remind people, thumbs up, thumbs down is good, because we've got a lot of people we want to hear from today. Thank you.
My name is Vivian Lyon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I represent tenants mostly in Portland, and I am here in support of this proposal, and I'm here to preemptively address an objection that the landlord's lobby has made to this proposal. They've put forward a number of nightmare scenarios they claim are or would be unintended consequences of the relocation assistance proposal. All of these scenarios are predicated on using the no-cause eviction process when the for-cause eviction process is available and is more appropriate. They claim that they need to use no-cause evictions because the for-cause process is too expensive and difficult, but they don't want to reward bad behavior with relocation costs. For instance, they've imagined a scenario in which a tenant is harassing children, and they claim that the landlord would prefer to use the no-cause eviction process to spare the young victims from having to testify. Another scenario they've put forward involves a situation in which a landlord lives on one side of a duplex and the tenant is causing disturbances on the other, the argument being that the landlord's testimony wouldn't be sufficient to show bad behavior. The key thing to note is that using a no-cause eviction in a situation in which a for-cause is called for is an end run around the due process of the tenant. These nightmare scenarios presume that the imaginary tenant is guilty, but in real life, we don't know whether a tenant is guilty of the behavior of which they're accused until they get their day in court. The consequences of false accusations of bad behavior can be homelessness. Shouldn't tenants who are suspected of violating the rental agreement get their day in court instead of facing a no-cause eviction, essentially convicted without a trial or the opportunity to present exonerating evidence? Should we really be encouraging landlords to use the no-cause eviction process as a way of depriving tenants from having a chance to defend themselves? The landlord's lobby would further have you believe that a for-cause eviction is much more expensive than a no-cause eviction. They're overstating the case considerably. Sure, trials can be expensive, but if you look through the court records on OECI, you'll see that eviction cases of any kind are frequently resolved prior to trial. They get settled at a first hearing through a stipulated agreement negotiated by the landlord's attorney and the tenant, usually unrepresented, in which the tenant agrees to pay the rent that they owe on a payment plan or agrees to alter their behavior, etc. By the way, this almost always results in the tenant being evicted because they can't hold to the terms of the agreement. In other words, most tenants get evicted with no trial. So the for-cause process is actually pretty cheap most of the time. And no-cause evictions are not without their own costs. It's not as simple as issuing the notice and your tenant meekly leaves without a fight. Tenants can contest them through affirmative defenses such as retaliation and habitability issues, as well as contesting that the service was improper. So my contention is that these lobbyists fighting to have the no-cause eviction process without the strings attached of the relocation assistance, their objections are spurious. They don't have a lot to do with the realities of practicing landlord-tenant law, and no-cause evictions should be used when there literally is no cause. They should not be a replacement for a situation in which a for-cause eviction would be appropriate. This relocation assistance proposal will not deprive landlords of a necessary tool to deal with bad tenants.
I have one question for the attorney. None of us here are landlord-tenant lawyers, so there's another scenario that has been raised in emails and letters we've gotten. I want to give you a chance to respond to it, which is that under this system, there will be an incentive to use the for-cause process more, and that somehow a for-cause eviction prevents that tenant from later being a successful tenant somewhere else. Could you address that?
So they're taking mercy on the tenant by using a no-cause when they could have used a for-cause?
I'm not judging it. I'm asking the question. One of the things that we try to prevent in our legislating and in our actions is putting any blemishes, if you will, on someone's balance credit sheet or something else that prevents them from being successful tenants. And one thing about our current market is people are being screened very carefully. The question is, does a for-cause eviction as a legal matter make it more difficult for that person to find another place to rent?
Yes, a for-cause eviction does make it more difficult for a person to find a place to rent. I'm not sure exactly what point you're making.
Not my point.
Can I respond?
That's why I was asking you. You're the lawyer.
Can I respond briefly to that, Commissioner Fish? So we at Human Solutions are also a landlord. We operate 700 units of affordable housing, and we, by the terms of our financing, are prohibited from using no-cause evictions. So if we have to move to eviction, it has to be for cause, and we are, because of our mission, loath to do that, but occasionally there are circumstances where we do that. Most frequently in that situation, it doesn't proceed to court, and there isn't a recorded judgment. The notice is issued, the case is settled before, and it's very easy for us as a and for any landlord attorney to work with a tenant in that situation, have them better understand the situation that they're facing. The most damaging thing on a tenant's record would be a judgment, but that case can be settled prior to a judgment that was for cause, even if the proceeding was initiated that way.
Make sure I understand this then. The benefit of for cause eviction process generally is it gives a measure of due process.
Yes.
And as a practical matter, very few of them result in judgment.
Yes.
Thank you. That's what I was looking for.
Thank you. And thank you, Chair Kafori, for being here and your years of leadership on this issue and many others. Thank you.
Okay, panel two, Tim Pitts, landlord and owner of Think Real Estate, Jenny Shaver from the Montevilla Neighborhood Association, and Margot Black of Portland Tenants United.
And Carla, I should have mentioned these are invited panelists, so you don't need to put the timer on.
Yeah, we asked.
Oh, you did?
Just
okay.
To try to keep a handle. She
runs a tight ship.
She sure does.
I've had to sit through 2 hours of testimony.
Good afternoon. If you could just state your name for the record.
Am I first?
Sure.
All right. My name is Margot Black. I'm sorry about the hat. Once you put it on, you can't take it off. So I'm speaking on behalf of Portland Tenants United, a Portland metro area tenants union, organizing tenants in their apartment complexes, neighborhoods, and this city to fight for housing dignity and security. I want to start by thanking Mayor Wheeler and Commissioner Udaly, and especially the folks in their offices who have been working so hard to bring this important and impactful emergency ordinance to the floor today. To vote and make immediately effective a tenant protection ordinance that will bring profound and palpable relief to the renters of Portland, especially those fearing or facing imminent displacement, serves as a model for how we should respond to emergencies. I'm not here to tell you my story of my two traumatic no-cause evictions I've endured. I want to speak today from the perspective of a tenant's advocate to the need and impact of tenants receiving relocation assistance. When a tenant receives a no-cause eviction or a rent increase that they simply cannot absorb, they have no choice. They must move. And to move means that they must start looking for, viewing, and applying for available rentals, a stressful process that requires time, energy, and money. Application fees are averaging $50 per adult. In a tight market, a tenant might have to fill out multiple applications, especially if they face any barriers. Once approved for new housing, they typically have very little time, a week or less, to sign the new rental agreement, put down a security deposit often equal to a month's rent or more, and begin paying rent on the new housing. Meanwhile, they are still paying rent at their current home. And to start living in that new home means it's time to pack, which means amassing boxes, then loading them into and out of a truck, and then cleaning. If the tenant has any hope of recovering a dollar of their security deposit, they must clean their rental from top to bottom, under the fridge and behind the oven. A rental agreement I recently looked at requires that tenants have the rugs, requires, have the rugs professionally cleaned on move-out, provide a receipt, and then stipulates that the property management company reserves the right to have them professionally cleaned, again, at the tenant's expense. Often, despite a deep clean and empty unit, the security deposit, not returned for 30 days post-move-out, is withheld anyway, and the tenants are sent a hefty bill. I did a move-out inspection with a very pleasant woman who was no-cause evicted after living in her apartment for 12 years. Among other egregious charges tallied on her $1,000 bill was $300 for repainting. One would think that a needed paint job after 12 years of tenancy would fall under normal wear and tear. Perhaps it does, but it's up to her to take her landlords to small claims court and make that case. Which is all to say, moving is expensive. The federal government knows this. They give us a tax deduction to move closer to work. Our employers know this. A moving stipend is often part of a new hire benefit package. Even the landlords know this. At the Multifamily Northwest Spring Apartment Breakfast in 2012, Maureen McNabb, CEO of Capital Property Management, broke down the costs of moving for her audience. boxes, moving truck, application fees, security deposit, a requisite trip to IKEA, and pizza and beer for friends could tally $1,625, she said. She mused that really could be up to $2,000 for the 20-something white, single, able-bodied man pictured on the PowerPoint screen behind her. Her itemized accounting didn't include the time off for work and finding new housing to pack and move, especially if that person is public transit dependent, nor the opportunity costs of being forced out of one's neighborhood and community, nor how these costs can mount when the renter isn't a single, childless, able-bodied white man with a bevy of able-bodied friends to schlep boxes and accept payment in pizza and beer. This was all used to say that landlords can go ahead and raise rents by 6 to 8% at that breakfast, considered quite high by their standards, and tenants have no choice but to pay them because moving is so expensive. The renters who call PTU in a desperate panic are those who need to be out tomorrow or yesterday or next week, and they haven't secured housing or packed their things because they're senior citizens, families, often single parents with children underfoot, folks with physical disabilities or illness, immigrant families, Section 8 voucher holders, and the rest of those that the housing market routinely discriminates against. They haven't managed to take the bus around town collecting boxes from grocery stores. There's no tribe of young bucks to haul their things into a U-Haul that they can't afford to take to their new apartment that they haven't secured because they have no way of coming up with a security deposit or paying double rent. And so they leave everything behind because there's no money for storage either. And anything left behind, they will not only need to pay to replace, but will be charged by their landlord to haul out, usually at a rate of $50 an hour, not including dump fees. These costs are real. There is no way to game the system with this ordinance because there is no way to move for free. These costs are significant, and when it is not the tenant's choice to incur them, it should not be the tenant's sole responsibility to pay them. The landlords in opposition to this ordinance will have many concerns, chief among them that they cannot possibly afford to write this relocation check. Well, neither can we. So perhaps when the landlord goes to write the rent increase notice or no-cause eviction, paying relocation costs will give them pause and help them recognize the financial consequences of their decision. If landlords declare that this will be their financial ruin, I implore you to ask them why they think their tenants are any better equipped to deal with it. Thumbs up, guys, thumbs up. While this ordinance does not prevent a no-cause eviction or egregious rent increase, we do hope that it gives our landlords pause, and fighting this pause is something they will also come to tell you about today. They will tell you that they need to use no-cause evictions, that for-cause evictions are too expensive, time-consuming, and require neighbors to testify against each other, putting themselves in danger. Commissioners, I don't deny that there are tenants who cause problems, but this ordinance isn't for them. No-cause evictions aren't for them. You will hear plenty of stories of awful tenants today, I'm sure. Please ask yourself why these landlords would rather give these dangerous, lecherous tenants 90 days notice without cause instead of 30 days or 72 hours, or in some of the more dangerous cases, 24 hours notice. And when a tenant given a for-cause eviction is so non-compliant that it requires a drawn-out court battle, including their neighbors testifying against them and the sheriff showing up at the door, do we really think these same tenants are just going to pack up and quietly leave with a no-cause eviction? Simply put, this problem tenant narrative is hyperbolic and is fundamentally dishonest. You are all on record supporting just cause eviction, so I ask that you reject this continued demonization of tenants as though they are third-tier citizens who don't know how to behave in civilized company. You will hear from tenants today who have been no-caused. Please recognize how many can't be here because they have to work, because rent. Please ask yourself if you believe that these tenants are really problem tenants whose neighbors can't testify against them. Tenants who get no-cause evictions are your friends and neighbors. We are parents, teachers, nurses, artists, students, journalists, retirees, social workers, and city commissioners. We are not the problem. The problem is a generation, well, actually a couple centuries, of housing policies that were built on the premise that to be a valid person is to own land. And we all know who was able to own land in this state until all too recently. It is time to address this injustice, to level the playing field. It is time to give tenants some dignity and security in their home and the ability to leave with dignity if they are forced out of it. The truth of the matter is that there are three reasons for no-cause eviction: retaliation, discrimination, and capitalism. And there are two types of landlords who give no-cause evictions: big landlords and mom and pop. Both use them, both abuse them. All of their tenants live in fear of the dreaded letter on the door. So as you consider a request to exempt small landlords, please realize that you are not exempting a landlord from a fee. You are exempting a tenant from a protection. I'm almost done. And by providing an exemption, you are providing a loophole. And loopholes have a funny way of getting exploited and taken advantage of. And then we come back here and say, relocation didn't work. With regards to unintended consequences, I ask you to think of the consequence of doing nothing. It has been 16 months since Justin Burry from the Community Alliance of Tenants sat here and asked City Council to show courage and take real action beyond just extending notice periods. And on tenant protections, we have done nothing. And the unintended consequences cannot be ignored. Our